what I think development is the shattering of the world as we know it to be able to accommodate a truer map of reality. And that shattering hurts.
Yeah.
It's very uncomfortable. But the more that we can accommodate what is true, the wiser we can be, the deeper our agency is, the more we can actually choose well. And the more we have a proper roadmap for what we're trying to navigate.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer. Today, we're posting part two of Desire, Difference, and the Path to Intimacy, a conversation that Dr. Finlayson Fife had with Taylor Church of the Of Stone and Clay podcast. It's the perfect episode for Christmas week because in it, you're going to learn a little bit more about Dr. Finlayson Fife's husband, John. Also, time is running out to take advantage of our Christmas sale where you can save 20% on any of Dr. Finlayson Fife's full-length courses. This includes her new Sex Worth Wanting course, which is phenomenal. You're going to love it. What makes this sale unique is that our bundle discount piles on top of the 20%. So when you purchase two full-length courses, you'll get an additional 10% off. And if you purchase three or more courses, you'll get an additional 15% off. Also, through Christmas, you can save $18 on your first year of Room for Two or on Room for Two gift subscriptions. So click the link in the show notes to learn more about these sales, and we're wishing you and yours a Merry Christmas. Enjoy the episode.
I'd love to hear a little bit about your husband and how you guys met and how you guys fell in love and stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So, John, I met him when I first moved to Boston. Mm-hmm. He was actually the first man I met there, and he showed up on the porch. I was painting.
Was he delivering a package?
No, he wasn't. Yeah. He was coming to see my roommate he was dating.
Classic. Okay.
But I was like covered in paint because I was painting my room. I had just moved in and the doorbell rang. So I opened the door and you know, he was coming to watch the US Open and he didn't have cable TV. Mm-hmm. And so he just gotten there ahead of his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up talking to him for about 10 minutes and I was just absolutely drawn to him. Yeah, I just saw him as this kind, smart person. He just seemed smart and kind and handsome. Mm-hmm. there was something about him that was just really both familiar and mysterious at the same time. I kept that to myself because he was dating my roommate, but I was kind of tracking that a little bit. And
I've done some tracking.
And then, you know, I think maybe 9 or 10 months later, they ended the relationship and she moved out of the country. And
you started going like this.
Yeah, exactly. How do I make it clear?
Yeah.
And he sailed a lot at the time. He had a couple of catamarans and, anyway, the short of it is I knew he wanted to sail on Lake Champlain. And so I invited him to come up and sail on Lake Champlain. And so I actually asked him out first time.
Awesome. I love it.
And he was like, oh, great. Who else is going to be there? And I'm like, well, my mom and sister. I was so embarrassed, but he was good about it. So our first date was going up to Vermont where my family was and sailing on Lake Champlain. But our first conversation was just very powerful for me. It was like a 3-hour drive. And I just felt like I could be myself already. Like I felt like I could talk to him about some of my questions and challenges around church and women's role in the church. And, you know, I had so many men that were calling me to repentance when I questioned things within our faith. And I just was so over that. I just needed to be with somebody that didn't want me to be different.
Right. And you didn't like being chastised?
No,
that's crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, here they'd bring me a list of scriptures to read. And I was like, and I just felt like not only did he understand it and wasn't threatened by it, that he had thought about it a lot himself. Mm-hmm. And so there was a resonance there for me right away. At the same time, I was actually afraid of feeling that resonance. Like I have to say, like I was afraid of marriage. I was afraid of losing myself in marriage. I had really grown up learning. I'd seen my mom in some ways defer so much to my dad. I'd also grown up learning that good women do that, that they take their husband's name, they kind of fall into his, that they're his support staff. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be married, but I didn't want to lose my life and lose my identity. And so I was just afraid of that possibility. You know, thankfully, John grew up in a family where his parents had both a very good marriage, and his mom was very much a force. You know, she just had her own, she was her own life force. Yeah. And John's dad loved and valued everything about her. And so we had a good role model and all of that. It just took me a while to work out my anxiety and really step in with both feet.
Yeah.
And so it took me like 2.5 years before I was like, okay, I'm really here for it. But, you know, as much as people around me were distressed by how long it was taking me, I'm really grateful I did that for me. Yeah. Because it was, by the time we were really getting married, we both were just truly solid. Choosing and knew what we were choosing and were really happy about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of distressed people out there for me.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, what's the matter with you? When are you going to get your...
Yeah, there's plenty of the matter with me. you know, over the years, what has been something that has really helped your guys' love evolve from, you know, that initial stage where it's almost obsession, you know, you're just so excited and the feelings are so new, but then, you know, you get a house together and you grow and you start to have children. What has maybe been a catalyst for that growth for you guys?
I would say the tolerance of honest conversations and even of conflict,
you know,
one thing about my husband is he doesn't like conflict, that's for sure. But, you know, we can stay pretty honest with each other. And I feel like the thing I was going to say is the thing about John is that he never goes to hostility. Mm-hmm. So it's just something I deeply appreciate that even if we are distressed or upset, it doesn't turn to hatred or like meanness towards the other person.
Yeah.
So we've been plenty mad at each other, you know, about things, but the basic desire to be at peace with each other, to find our way to an honest peace has really been there. And I'm really grateful for John's contribution to that because I think he had stronger intuition around that than I did even. Mm-hmm. And I think that it just felt real. I mean, you know, like, so even if we were unhappy with each other, it wasn't like, you know, either one of us was like creating deeper and deeper resentment or isolation or pulling away. So we just would kind of stay in it until we could find something that we were both at peace enough with.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you, I feel like so many of us, it's our natural default setting to just be like, when there's discord, to be like, well, I'm right though, and you're wrong. So can you get on my side? Like, how do you help people have a more open mindset in, you know, when you're arguing and when you're fighting to approach it with the mindset that, well, I actually might be wrong too, or I might be at fault too.
Well, I think part of it is just understanding what the goal is. I mean, the goal isn't about who's going to prevail. It's like you're trying to forge a life with this person.
Yeah.
And they're not just going to disappear. I mean, they care about something. And so if you love them, the uncomfortable work is sorting out who they are, how they experience you, why they're not okay with the thing that you're so okay with. Mm-hmm. And trying to increase the IQ of the conversation. Like, what are we actually trying to build a bridge across? You know, what, and this comes up in parenting, like, why do you see it this way? And the thing is, they're not crazy. They see something.
Yeah.
And oftentimes what happens in marriage is people tend to polarize, like they get really fixated on one side of the argument and the other one on the other. They're both right. Mm-hmm. And the only way you're going to solve it is if you can come to like understand how you're both right. I mean, so then what do you do with that? How do you make something work given that both of these pieces are true and in fact matter? But it's that process that allows your creativity to emerge, allows you to actually forge something that's really about who the two of you are.
Yeah.
what our lesser selves want to do is just duke it out in the kind of who's going to win.
Yeah.
So it's not that you're wrong when you feel that you're right. It's mm-hmm. that if I'm going to build a marriage with this person, I need to understand how they are right.
Yeah. And not be competitive with them.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so much what we want to do in marriage. And, you know, we just want to win.
Yeah.
But then you have two losers.
Right. Gosh. Yeah. You guys have kids?
Yeah.
Three kids?
Yeah.
How have you talked to your kids about sex? What's a good approach with that?
Yeah, well, just have sex books all over the place and then they're...
Oh, right, right.
Well,
Just let them into your office.
Yeah, what I mean is, like, in some ways it wasn't in the forbidden range. Mm. And so it was pretty normal. And so it was a pretty normal part of the interactions and the conversations. But also they were well aware that people have challenges around it too. So it wasn't quite so much fascination. I think maybe mm-hmm. it was a little bit like understanding that relationships can be hard too for people. But, you know, I think we just made it a normal part of life. We talked about it being a normal and a good part of life. We talked about the importance of making careful decisions because it is a powerful way of being in connection with another person. Mm-hmm. I think because there wasn't shame and anxiety, you know, none of my kids were sort of compulsive or reckless about it. You know, that just hasn't been their challenge. So yeah. They've had other challenges, but sure. It hasn't been in that domain. They understand it as a normal and a good part of life. And they've actually been pretty conservative in their choices, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. They obviously have access to your office and your office hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Another quote I wanted to bring up. I heard you mention in this little mini documentary I was watching where you took all these couples on kind of a retreat.
Yeah.
And I'd like to talk a little bit about that, but you said, you know, everyone always says the truth sets you free, but you said the truth makes you suffer and then it sets you free. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, just what I think development is the shattering of the world as we know it to be able to accommodate a truer map of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that shattering hurts.
Yeah.
It's very uncomfortable. But the more that we can accommodate what is true, the wiser we can be, the deeper our agency is, the mm-hmm. more we can actually choose well. And the more we have a proper roadmap for what we're trying to navigate. And I think that marriage, you know, I used to think I was a nicer person before I got married. And then when I got married, I realized I could be competitive or could be withholding or could be self-serving. And it was nothing like a marriage to kind of reveal your challenge in loving another person really knowing another person or making room for them. And so intimate connection reveals you to yourself.
Yeah.
And gives you the opportunity to learn to love if you will allow that self-awareness to, you know, cultivate that desire in you. But that process hurts. We like our ideas. We prefer the world yields to us. We prefer a spouse yields to us.
Mm-hmm.
But what love asks of us is that we grow into somebody that can truly value another person and value how they are in the world and facilitate the thriving of others, not just ourselves.
Yeah.
So it's a process, but if we understand the value of that process, mm-hmm. right, then we can say, hey, it's just pain.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just disillusionment. And I know I'm saying that a little bit flippantly, but you can better understand what you're doing. It's like going to the gym. You're like, yes, it's uncomfortable, but I know what the larger goal is. And so that's why I'm here for it.
Right. And you said it can be like a shattering experience, but if you're sort of consistently seeking truth, it becomes kind of muscle memory.
It does.
It's not so shattering.
100%.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, if you just go to the gym and you're like, I'm going to absolutely destroy every muscle group I have.
Right.
It is going to be shattering.
Oh, it's going to be horrible. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
But at some point you're just like, well, this is still a little arduous, but it's not so bad.
Exactly. And I think it's very true. The more you get used to the process of, you know, if you're in a conversation with your spouse and you know, okay, this is just the process. This is how it's been before. It's just so much easier, even though, you know, it's never fun to hear the invalidating idea mm-hmm. from your spouse. It's never fun to hear what they have to say if it's not a positive picture. But if you understand this is how it goes,
mm-hmm.
I always get on the other side of it. Life's always a little better after I do. You can just accept it better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you feel like are some, maybe not misnomers, but some things that men should know about women that they tend to not, and vice versa.
Well, I think women have more sexual capacity than men do, but women are just pickier about allowing it to show up.
Right.
First of all, often women are afraid to know this capacity in themselves. Uh-huh. And so they may be slow to forge a relationship to their eroticism. They're also very attuned to the question of, does this person love me and want me to thrive? Mm-hmm. Can I respect myself to let another person know who I am? And is he here for it? Because I think masculine energy, strong masculine, facilitates the thriving of the feminine. Like, you know, yang or masculine is the frame. The art is yin or feminine, right? Mm-hmm. In good sex, the man is the rhythm section and the woman is the radiating energy, right? Mm-hmm. She's the pleasure. And I think that it takes strong men to really want their wives to even surpass them sexually.
Right.
And so a lot of men want more the woman that slides underneath them and kind of makes them feel big.
Yeah.
That will kill her sexual energy. Mm. And it's, you know, I just know men that would rather critique their women's low desire and even do things that facilitate her low desire unwittingly, because then they can feel superior to her. And they don't realize that they're actually afraid of her thriving. Mm. They're afraid if she's thriving, maybe she wouldn't want me, wouldn't choose me. Mm. And so...
So it just comes from deep insecurity.
Deep insecurity, and men are often unwittingly co-creating a low desire wife. Mm. Now, it's a co-creation. I don't mean that men are just doing it to women. Women are also making decisions about how much they're going to show up and how much risk they'll take and how much they're going to value themselves and their own feminine capacity and brilliance, right? So women have a lot of sexual capacity and a high capacity for pleasure. So that's important.
I mean, it's obvious just in the fact that they can have multiple orgasms. Yeah,
absolutely.
And we sure can.
Multiple orgasms, full body orgasms. Yeah. I mean, you know, and so...
Yeah, they were made for this.
Yeah, exactly. there's some Greek mythology around this where Tiresias was cursed, quote unquote, to be a woman. And for a period of time, and then he was made a man again. And so then Zeus and Hera asked him, you know, basically who has more sexual capacity, man or woman? And he said, if love's pleasure adds up to 10, 9 parts go to women and 1 part goes to men. And so women can, they can have really deep, full body, soulful, multiple orgasms. Yeah. Now, I mean, most people are probably like, I'd like to have one, please. You know? And so I don't mean to say like, but women have high sexual capacity, but they're very careful about where that shows up. Because it's vulnerable to be sexual.
Right. And it's very connected to emotional stuff where men can compartmentalize better.
That's right. I think that's right.
And then, what should women know about men?
Well, that they're not women.
Yeah.
You know, that I think sometimes women want the masculinity and the strength and the stoicism that men often have while having the kind of emotional presence that a girlfriend has. And I think it's like not really fair to want that. I just don't think it's really who you married.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my marriage got a lot better when I stopped wishing John was kind of the validating female energy in my life. Because that's just not who I married. And I even dated guys that were more like that and I wasn't attracted to them.
Right.
And just knowing like, is he invested in me or not? Does he know me? I think that's an important question. Yeah. Does he understand me? That's important, which is very different than you're going to be present in a way a girlfriend might be present.
Right.
I think that's a different idea.
Have you asked him to be more validating?
Oh, I certainly tried in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, I was more along the lines of like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you tell me these? Why don't you say these things to me more? You know, it was more kind of negative and challenging. So I certainly did do that in the beginning. And then I think after a few years, I just realized like he really does know me and he really does love me, and stop trying to get him to be someone he's not. Like just accept that everything he does is evidence that he's invested in me.
Right.
He really is. And so it's okay that he doesn't go around validating me. And I just want to be somebody that's strong enough to see him properly and not need so much reassurance. And that what's kind of interesting though is like just not being so needy that way. I actually feel like he's much more verbally validating than he used to be, maybe just because it's freer to do it, because it's not.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's pressure.
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How dangerous is it? I feel like women usually are the culprits here, but how dangerous is it for a woman to sort of, you know, have sex be like, okay, when you're good,
yeah, no,
we can have sex. If you behave tonight, yeah. If you're nice to me, like all these things, they kind of dangle it as a reward. How dangerous is that?
Very. I just don't think that's the right way to think about it. Certainly not as a reward.
Yeah.
And I don't think that a man should think about it that way either. I mean, I don't think he should accept that idea. I mean, the way I think about it is that the emotional and sexual intimacy of a marriage matters, and both shape and affect each other. It's mm-hmm. not like the sex is the frosting and the emotional part is the real marriage. I mean, they're all a part of the marriage. And so when a marriage is really good, it's a reward for both people.
Right, right.
It's not like his reward, because it just means that there's something then in the sexual relationship that's not about the two of you really enjoying each other mm-hmm. and coming together. And so probably if sex is really good for both, it might mean she's rallying more than she would. You know, women are a little bit like, men are like, you know, squirrel, squirrel. Men are often noticing their wives and feel spontaneous desire a lot more. Women are more like, you know, like the computer just goes into sleep mode, and women often just kind of go into sleep mode, and they're, it doesn't mean that they're not sexual, but they need the mouse to be knocked around a little bit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. A woman can walk in the right pair of pants and the guy's like,
right. Like, why wouldn't I want? Yeah. You're right. Like, everything in you is making me want this. And she's like, what is the matter with you?
Yeah,
like,
there's no pant a man can wear.
No, because it's exactly. It's unfortunate for the men, but that is hard for men. They are the ones that are more in pursuit and kind of going out in the invitation. Mm-hmm. And I would say women have, you know, to love a man is to recognize that's where he's operating from. Right. And not because he has needs. I wouldn't put it that way, but that's the gift and what he's bringing to the marriage. And it doesn't mean that you can't say no by any stretch, mm-hmm. but you married a man. And so don't treat it like it's a lesser part of the marriage or of him.
Don't be upset when he's a man.
Yeah. And you don't want him to not desire you, do you? Yeah. Like, it's like women do want to feel desired. They just don't want to feel obligated.
Right.
And they don't want to feel pressured, and they don't want to feel that there's something wrong with them just because they don't operate like their husband does.
Yeah.
Men shouldn't pathologize women's lower desire. I mean, because they're operating in a different biology. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't have a pretty matched marriage.
Yeah.
Because when sex becomes desirable, I mean, I seldom feel spontaneous desire, especially being postmenopausal and all that. Very seldom do I just feel it in my body first. Right. But I value that experience very much. Like mm-hmm. it's a meaningful part of my life. So I like my husband's invitations because it's like it's an opportunity to move in that direction and towards something that's great for me and it's great for us. So, you know, when it's something that you both really like, well, then those biological differences just aren't as big a deal.
Yeah. Is that one of your goals as a counselor, is to get couples to be closer to the same level of desire or not?
I might say it a little differently. I think the goal is for there to be more erotic energy in the marriage, mm-hmm. more life energy, more of a sense of enjoyment of each other, and having that be a more regular part of the connection.
Yeah.
That it's not so intercourse centric, mm-hmm. and it's much more about a kind of energy that they feel together.
That can facilitate that energy.
Yeah, like exactly. And just exactly. It's very important for that to be kind of happening throughout, so that when you climb in bed at night, it's already kind of there.
Right, right.
And it's often the man bringing that energy to her. It's how he looks at her. Mm-hmm. It's that he's like, I see you, I notice you, I find you attractive. And without any expectations.
Right.
The reason why a lot of women don't like that, if their husbands are like touching them, is they feel like it's linked to obligation. Mm-hmm. That if they're turning him on, they have to manage that need.
Yeah.
And so then they're like, I'm trying to do dinner, will you leave me alone? You know, it's all seen as pressure, as opposed to,
well, we can have a late dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the problem?
Exactly. How to say it? We want to be free around our sexuality. Mm-hmm. And if it gets linked to obligation, then then Eros dies.
It's not a sexy feeling.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And if it's linked to measurement and self-judgment, Eros dies. Mm-hmm. So I want people to feel more freedom with each other and more freedom to enjoy each other, because that's the sustaining energy. And when that shows up in sex, it's really good sex.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What's a really nice definition of Eros?
It's the desire for communion. Mm-hmm. It's the desire for honest connection with another, with something outside of ourselves that fills us with life. Mm-hmm. And so it's that part of us that wants to expand. It makes us feel alive. In Greek mythology, it's the life force.
Mm, yeah, I like that. Have you ever read The Four Loves?
Yes.
By C.S. Lewis?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, he has a whole chapter on Eros.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I love his writing on it.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's really cool. When you're thinking about your own relationship and relationship for others, do you feel like the love languages that are so popularized matter?
Very slightly.
Okay.
So I guess what I would say is it's always good to know who your partner is, mm-hmm. and what speaks to them.
All right. So it's more important to know the love languages than to have similar love languages.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I'm even kind of guarded around those love languages. The reason is because I think a lot of couples use them manipulatively.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like, you're not speaking my love language. I do not feel loved. Okay. Right. So you have to do this thing because I just can't understand any other way to be loved.
It's limiting.
It's very limiting, and it's often used to kind of extract validation as opposed to just knowing who your partner is. Mm-hmm. So if it helps you know better who they are, sure. And if it helps you make decisions because, hey, I know it means something to my spouse if I get them a gift, even though that's not my thing. I just know that she or he likes that. Mm-hmm. Sure. I think it's a great thing to do. It's coming out of your agency.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's got to be more than five love. I mean, there's like, how to say it? Just knowing your spouse, right. You're going to realize what things really matter to them and speak to them. But I also think, just like, you know, I could have argued my love language is affirmation. Is that one of them? Yeah. You know, so therefore, John, you should be telling me what you love about me.
Yeah.
I just think part of growing up is like seeing that he's not an extrovert. He doesn't live in the world that way.
Right.
I chose someone purposefully that kind of wasn't that.
Yeah.
And so stop punishing him for not being exactly what I need. Yeah, now, yeah. I could say, like, I always love it when you say those things. Mm-hmm. But I also know that you're different than me.
Yeah.
So it's okay to reveal yourself and say, like, that does always speak to me. I always love to hear it from you. But I'm not going to badger you for not just doing what makes me feel good all the time.
Yeah.
I want to be more than that. I want to be able to love another person.
Right. Yeah. I like that. I think it is really limiting to say, like, okay, there's five ways to show love.
Yeah, no.
Right? It's like there's a million ways.
There's a million ways.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's a million ways. And it's like, what is actually needed right now? What's actually the way to be kind to this other person? What is the way to actually make room for them to know who they are? I mean, who cares what language it is? You're just, that's your goal, is their well-being.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you worked with people that really, I'm sure you have, but just really struggle with physical touch, period? Like, it's not necessarily that they're repulsed by their spouse's touch, but they just struggle to enjoy physical touch. How do you work with them?
Well, I would say, first of all, there are people that probably have neurological challenges around mm-hmm. that, so that physical touch can be aversive for just biological reasons. What I have found more commonly is that people associate touch with a kind of taking. And it's aversive because they're dysregulated in the touch. So, like, I have people that start to dislike, they like don't want their spouse to touch them. It's aversive. But if they're touching their children, it's not aversive.
Right. So it's not actually touch.
It's not actually touch. It's the meaning of the touch. And one of the things I teach in my courses is how much meaning shapes pleasure and desire. Because we want to be free. We want to feel that in being sexual, it's expanding our sense of self, not making us have to be something for someone else. And so if you feel like every time your spouse touches you, you're getting obligated, it's going to be super aversive.
Yeah.
No matter, it's not even a technique problem, it's a meaning problem. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so then it's, I'm trying to deal with the meanings and help them see, like, is it that the spouse is actually taking, and or is it that the receiver on that side is so walled off and anxious that they can't process touch in a way that would actually lead to pleasure because they're trying to control their availability to the marriage mm-hmm. as opposed to learning how to be themselves in the marriage.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, we'll wrap up here, but what is your advice for someone like me that is just out there dating, trying to envision all these things for the future, but doesn't mm-hmm. really maybe have a great way of practicing in the meantime, yeah. right?
Well, it's an imperfect process. I mean, so much of me getting married was just coming to terms with finiteness. Yeah. I mean, actually, you know, so there's something about really choosing another person that is challenging mm-hmm. if you're awake enough to yeah. see, like, I'm not marrying someone who's going to solve life's problems yeah. for me or make me happy at all times. I'm choosing another real person who at times will drive me crazy mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. and still going to choose it. So which person do I most want to be driven crazy by at times? Yeah. Right, I think right. that's kind of what the question is like. And sometimes that just comes down to that you just, at least for me, it was like, I just couldn't end it with John. Like I couldn't choose in, but I couldn't choose out either. And
right.
just something about him compelled me. It was sometimes what I call, it's like super rational. It's like above rationality. It's something that the soul longs for.
Yeah.
And so it's like allowing that to be real information for you. Mm-hmm. But give me your question one more time just so I make sure I'm covering what you were asking.
I think
so.
You covered it.
Did I?
Yeah, okay. It was great. What is another question just came to my mind? I mean, what is for you your favorite thing about love?
Gosh, with my husband specifically?
Yeah.
I mean, let me think. It's just the sense of friendship. It's that I have a person that is home, you know? Mm-hmm. I go do a lot and outdo these things. And there's just something about coming home.
Yeah.
And there he is, and he loves me, and he knows me, and it's a place of comfort, it's a place of pleasure, it's a place of friendship, and, you know, I mean, especially in a world that's so fractured and uncertain and loss is everywhere, you know, to just have a friend is such a, it's worth creating.
Yeah.
It's worth creating.
Yeah, I feel like I could pretty easily tell from the relationships I hear about if they're great or not by... Is there a sense of dread in going home?
Yeah, exactly.
Even if you've been out of town for 5 days and you're kind of yeah. like, all right, I got to get back to the wife. I'm like, kill
no,
me.
No, that's not good.
Yeah.
No.
But there are some that are like, dude, I'm just so excited to go see my
yeah.
wife.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
That's, yeah.
Exactly. And yeah, no, I have had plenty of clients that would like come home from work and sit in the driveway for yeah. a while because they don't want to walk in. And that's really important to deal with as a couple, like right. what's happening, that being here feels aversive and how much is it about the one at home and how much is it about the one coming home? But can we learn to love each other?
Yeah.
Those are just such important life questions. And, you know, this is like kind of the crucible of marriage is like, I've either got to learn how to really love this person and take on that challenge or suffer the pain of separation, which is also so painful. And so which pain do I choose? And often that's where marriage puts us is, what am I going to do with my unhappiness here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, doctor, thank you so much for joining. Like I said, I read the introduction to your new book, That We Might Have Joy. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm really excited to read the whole thing.
Yeah.
So if you could sort of encapsulate in one sentence, what the book is it about? Is it about infusing joy into a marriage?
Yeah. You know, I'm borrowing a scripture from my faith tradition, from mm-hmm. from the Book of Mormon, that we are that we might have joy, that's really what we're here for. And yeah. yet so often in religion, we live as though long suffering is God's plan, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like miserable obedience and the reward will be in the next life. And nowhere is the possibility of joy kind of greatest than in marriage. So that is to say, because of the fullness of what a relationship can be, that we really can know joy through the body and especially in intimate love. And so it's really a book about kind of what are many of our inherited traditions. And they're not, you know, this is just many of us as Christians or growing up in conservative religions learn to fear sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so I'm taking what I see as when we inherit that meaning, how it challenges marriages and fundamentally creates a division within ourselves and within our marriage and even within our relationship with the divine. Mm. And so we have to heal that relationship to be at peace in ourselves and to create something intimate and rich. And in that, you know, speaking of C.S. Lewis, who talks about erotic love or eros love, is that in that coming together, we can actually touch divinity. We can know something at a deeper level in the masculine and feminine coming together. And so it's just showing people what that process is, how we can use marriage to grow and to learn, and how we can actually forge more peace with ourselves, more peace in our marriage, and more peace in our sexual relationship.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Because I think so many people view marriage as almost just part of life. It's sort of a logical next step in your progression as an adult, instead of viewing it as like this wonderful thing that can bring the most joy in life.
Yeah. The happiest people, the research suggests, are, first of all, 50 or older.
Congrats.
And so they've kind of gotten through a lot of the anxieties of life, but they're married and that they enjoy the marriage. So that is that there's just something about creating that level of a connection that really is just good for us. It, of course, not everybody will create that. You can create meaningful relationships. So having meaningful relationships is the most important factor in happiness. And of course, marriage is one of those and an important one of those. But yeah, I think that if we don't understand what marriage can be, then we have a hard time creating it if we are married.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm going to put in my calendar when I turn 50 to be really happy. Something to look forward to.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.